Ice cold beer!
Popcorn, peanuts, Cracker Jack.
I know what the big deal about Cracker Jack is. Did you ever go and buy a pack of Cracker Jack thinking you'd get a prize and find no prize in the box?
Today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth.
To the ball game, take me out to the crowd, buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I don't care if I ever get back. We'll root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. 1, 2, 3 strikes you out at the old ball game.
All right, welcome back to the Bench Jockeys here on 101.5 UMFM. I'm Michael Ells, and joining me from a safe distance, my pal Brian Svensson.
Hello.
And a special guest this week, the host of Dagwood Radio. He's back in our lives, Connor Milligan.
Happy to be here.
Now, Connor, we picked you because we're focusing on a team and on a show that is near and dear to your heart, the Oakland Athletics and the movie Moneyball. And we're going to be talking a little bit about our rewatch of that. Maybe you can tell us how you ended up being an Oakland Athletics fan of all things.
Well, it's one of the things I have to explain the most, but most think it's from this movie, which you get razzed about all the time. But it actually started off when I was playing ball between being a catcher and a pitcher. And I loved catching, and they started me throwing on the mound and realized I couldn't throw anywhere near fast enough. So I got hooked on, or I got given a tape, a Learn to Pitch by Barry Zito, a VHS.
Barry Zito.
So, Barry yeah. Zito.
So it was like, this guy's made a living in just throwing pure junk. And I was like, that's my ticket in. So I actually never went back to catching after getting that tape. Gotcha. So then it just kind of continued on after that. Then it just, I mean, they get in, regardless what fan you are of baseball, they get inside your heart some way or another.
Yeah, and it's usually like a guy like a Barry Zito.
Yeah.
Right, like it's not the superstar, it's the like the person that's near and dear to your own heart.
Yeah. Although the A's have a superstar right now.
Oh, Chapman absolutely.
Is incredible. That guy's incredible.
It's that classic 6-year span in baseball, right, where they finally get that pro status and we get these great guys coming in, and then they get to the end and then they just get kind of pillaged off, and that's the end of it for the team, and we go back down for a little bit. But
yeah, I mean, last time that happened, that ended up being okay for the Blue Jays, as we ended up with MVP Josh Donaldson. So yeah. I'm pretty okay if we end up with MVP Matt Chapman. Well, I guess we'll see, but
yeah. So about every 4 or 5 years, we really love baseball in Oakland, and then you go back into the bottom for a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. So let's get into that, because one of the quotes in the movie that caught my eye and caught my ear, and probably hurts you a little bit, is when so Billy Bean is talking to his owner and he says, "We're the organ donors for the rich, we're the last dog at the bowl." And obviously this is something that's repeated over the entirety of Billy Bean's tenure, right? I mean, this is decades now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's it like knowing kind of that's kind of how it works with your club?
Well, the only quote that's ever come to mind when people ask me about being a fan of the team is throwing punches underwater.
Like, oh,
we get this great, we have a really talented scouting staff that bring in these great players for pretty cheap. And then we finally get to the point where we've developed them to where the rest of the league takes notice and they go off. But I think it's the nice thing is that it's just always an underdog story. Like, regardless, whenever they're in the wild card, you always take that. The loss is somewhat expected, which makes the victories a little bit better, which we haven't had in a while. But it's yeah, it's always that underdog aspect of the team, which I've always enjoyed about them. But I think the town's like that too, right? Right from the stadium and their fight to get a new stadium now, it just seems like everything's always been up against them. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the Coliseum scene kind of inside it here, and we're joined by bullpen phone by Chris Suk, who is going to get back in on the show as well. Hopefully, he hears us in a second. But yeah, like just even the home team's locker room that you see in this, it's just like barren.
Yeah.
And, you know, having had the opportunity to tour a few different ball clubs, and that's usually kind of what like the visitors clubhouse looks like generally, like that kind of just really Spartan thing. And to see that's what the home team gets in Oakland is it's funny
when you read comments, the movie, how they're like, it's amazing how they staged the locker room to make the financial look even worse. I'm like, no, that was shot at the call. Like that's it.
Yeah, they actually shot it at the Coliseum, which is, you know, crazy. And you know, one of the quotes that always kind of sticks with me, or I always laugh at, is when Billy comments to one of the guys, he's, the smell's getting worse. And, you know, like, that's just always a problem with – one of the problems with Oakland, with the Coliseum that they mention not in real life, is that there's sewage. Yeah. That it, like, overflows with sewage in both dressing rooms all the time. And the players just have to deal with that, which is disgusting.
The rain delays are awesome because the commentary for radio, I subscribe to it, and they always say on a rain delay, they have to tarp the field and cover the toilets. It's, like, hilarious.
That's disgusting. It's funny, but disgusting.
Yeah, it is.
Absolutely. So we'll back the train up to the beginning of the movie there. First of all, I just want to note, can we remember a time when Rudy Giuliani wasn't the butt of a joke and, you know, just an awful human being? It's funny to see the 0-1 playoffs and see Rudy Giuliani in the crowd cheering for the Yankees as the A's play them. And just like, wow, what a time 19 years has changed things up. But that was definitely the first thing that stuck out to me.
Yeah. Right off the bat, you want to root for Oakland in that movie.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, let's talk a little bit about kind of the movie itself. Kind of general thoughts. Like, Brian, I know you love the book Moneyball.
Yeah, I love the movie too. But like with most movies,
you not like Brad Pitt?
No, I love the movie. I think he does an incredible job. I just they're like movies that have been made from books. It leaves out so much, mm-hmm. and the movie tends to focus on three players mostly, right? It focuses on Chad Bradford, it focuses on Scott Hatterberg, and it focuses on David Justice. And those are great players.
David Justice.
Yeah. But it doesn't, those guys were good and they had good seasons that year for the Oakland A's, but you know, it almost completely neglects the incredible three-headed rotation that they had of Zito, Hudson, and Mulder. Mm-hmm. It completely neglects the insane season that Eric Chavez had. It completely neglects the insane season that Miguel Tejada had. And even on the trade deadline part of the movie, they make it out to be that Ricardo Rincon is you know, this huge acquisition that sends him on this 20-game win streak, when in reality, it's the acquisition of Ray Durham, right? And none of those guys even get touched on, other than maybe a few shots here or there. And that really bugged me. But, you know, the tone of the movie.
But it's not a documentary, right?
No. And that's fair. But, I mean, like, I do think that, like, they should have been mentioned at least a little bit.
I will say this. I think Brian's right about that, is in regards to, I didn't know. I had to look that up again about how good that 2002 team was.
106
They had a Cy Young Award winner plus an MVP, you know? Like, that's – and the streak, of course, right? But I think the movie did a very good job as the streak, right? I think a lot of that movie is that, you know, they were in the depths of these guys might have got fired. And then they do the streak, and then, of course, and they still lose because that's who the Oakland A's are. But and then, you know, it's interesting also the end about sort of that he decides to stay, and you know, of course, the Red Sox go on and win a World Series in a couple of years, right?
Yeah.
Like, they focus so much on the statistics aspect of the movie and how this is changing baseball, how they look at it, when in reality, that final quote in the movie, the guy saying is, "It's you still have to play ball," and they leave out the fact that a lot of guys were playing great fundamental baseball. It wasn't just this complete numbers game, right?
Yeah, and I mean that quote at the end there, and that those same kind of quotes throughout the whole thing, where it is that one gentleman that is supposed to be mimicking, or maybe it's straight up ripped from Joe Morgan, who is not is well known as a very hated figure by quants around the internet. People who like sabermetrics do not like Joe Morgan. And so it was just, for me at least, it was funny that they kept having Joe Morgan quotes in there, just to kind of highlight how stupid it sounded in post-sight, you know, hindsight.
Which I discovered afterwards is actually not Joe Morgan audio. It's actor Ron Canada reading the lines as if he's Joe Morgan.
Yeah.
I totally got fooled by that too. And I was looking for, you know, use of his clips in the credits or something like that, and then going online afterwards, that was one of the things I discovered. Also discovered that most of the scouts in the draft room are actual scouts.
No way.
Yeah. So what had happened was, originally this was supposed to be Steve Soderbergh was attached to this project initially. His hope was to use the actual players to play themselves. When that deal fell through, and then Bennett Miller, the eventual director, came in. When he was doing background and trying to get a sense of like how the scouts talk, and having Brad Pitt sit in on it, he's like, we're just going to film this. And they reacted to Pitt as if he was the Billy Bean figure. And what they say is basically just what they would say in the room regardless. Other so than they, that one, obviously the scout who, you know, loses it on him and gets fired.
Right. Did they get just other Oakland A scouts? At like older Oakland A scouts to come and play basically themselves?
So these were like current scouts in the like time at which they filmed it, like 08, 09.
That's super cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
I think the best part of that is it gives you that look into how much not only the skill player has through a draft aspect, but also like they were talking about how like a guy just looks good. He's like, he looks the part. He talks the part. This is like, they're going through how many aspects are actually looked at when drafting a baseball player, which I think is so interesting. What this movie shows too is that, like, even down to the point of when they're sitting with Billy Bean in high school at the table, and how they're showing that it's just like BS after BS to get this kid to sign.
Right.
Billy doesn't want to do that in the future, right? Which I think is such an interesting look into the sport.
Yeah, it kind of neglects. I mean, that was a part in the book that didn't really, I thought, didn't translate well. In the book, they have alternating chapters in between stuff that's going on in the big leagues and then stuff that happened in the past with his career. And it didn't really highlight how Billy kind of knew immediately that he was not set up for baseball. And it also doesn't show how good of a fielder he still was. Right? That like even though he was a horrible hitter, and that was because of his mental inabilities to cope with the stress of that. There's no kind of stress for his fielding. And in the majors, Billy Bean ended up being a very good fielder, just a lousy hitter.
Yeah, it just alludes to it a bit, right? It kind of is on the peripheral of Bean's career. I have to look it up a bit because I think one of the things is because he was a first round pick.
Right.
That's where the pressure was on Billy Bean, right? So I think, you know, he comes in and there's a lot of expectation because you see in the movie, he strikes out, and then Strawberry comes up next beside him, right?
So right.
He's in, like, he's hit, they're sort of kind of, but it's not a major thrust as much as probably in the book, just because of probably time constraints.
Yeah, no, obviously.
They've got only so many narratives you got to do.
Right, and that's the kind of thing. Like, obviously, it's a 2-hour movie, and they have to try and fit as much in as they can. And this movie might have been one of those things that came 5 years too early. Like, how insanely good would this have been as an 8-episode Netflix series, right? Like,
oh sure. I mean, if you're watching the Last Dance right now, I mean, it just shows people are eating this up, and we're only on to, you know, episode 3 and 4 right now. They've got a 10-parter, right? But yeah, yeah. I mean, you could have just had a whole movie just on the streak alone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the motivation for Bean, obviously with those flashbacks, it does hint at the fact that he's skeptical of scouts and their like inherent bias based on his own experience. But I think you're kind of left as an audience member to like kind of discern that on your own, right? Because when he first goes to Cleveland and meets with Shapiro, and then just like as he's walking through the like warren of offices, is like just stops and goes over to the Jonah Hill character, and you don't really get like a full sense like what's his motivation for doing that.
Now, is that for real or is that a movie deal? Is that a movie? Was that for real or was that just a movie thing?
So that's a movie thing in the sense that, like, first of all, that character is somewhat of a composite, but also mostly Paul De Podesta. But that's not necessarily how the two of them met, right? Like that he wasn't in a room with like nine Cleveland executives or, that's kind of how that went down. But yeah, you're kind of left to intuit throughout the rest of the movie, like this is why he is the way he is. And so open to this kind of like drastic shift. But I mean, you also have to get a sense that like it's a desperation play, right? Like that he knows he's not going to get any more money. So he can't compete on the like free agents and just buying wins. So he's got to figure out a different way to get them. I mean, that's really kind of that mindset shift that, you know, even just kind of like, we're not, when the scouts are like, oh, we need to replace like this many runs. And, you know, he's like, nope. He's like, what's his on base percentage? What's his get on base. Right. Like,
which is kind of like one of the funniest lines in the movie where he's like, there are rich teams and there are poor teams. Then there's 50 feet of crap. And then there's us. Just such a funny line.
I think there's so like, especially the one that sets in part where it kind of gives you the mindset that he's really against modern scouting or how scouting is done in baseball at the time, is when he calls pretty much loaded Jonah Hill in the middle of the night and tells him, when would you have drafted me? And he says, finally, ninth round, he knows that there's no BS with it. Like he can see through a lot of all the icing on top that they'll talk about with the player.
Yeah. He says,
how great. Ninth,
no signing bonus.
Yeah. How great is Brad Pitt though? Like just like the way all the little ticks, right. Where, you know, he totally does the whole I'm drunk at 3 a.m. type of thing. Well, in that particular instance where he's like, yeah, I would take you ninth, no signing bonus. He's like, yeah, it's so great. There's so many little ticks. And, you know, another one that he does really well is when he's in the guitar shop with his daughter and just like the stunned oddness that he has at his daughter singing is like, you can just picture any parent doing that. That's like a totally genuine reaction.
Or the ice cream sundae scene when she's telling him, asking if he's going to get fired, and he tells her not to go on the internet, not to talk to people, not to read a newspaper.
Yeah.
Like, it's perfect. But even the trade scene, right? Like the trade scene is one of the best GM scenes in sport movie history.
He starts whacking the phone after the conference call.
The way he's like hammering popcorn out of a coffee filter, like every like spits it out when the phone comes through.
The
like,
eating thing I thought was great because he brought that back from Ocean's 11, right?
Eating in just about every scene.
Yeah, in the rewatch, I'm like, oh, he's got, you know, an ice cream sundae. He's got popcorn. He's taking the nuts out of Mark Shapiro's bowl. He's doing all this like food work.
Yeah, and when he goes to Hatterberg's house, he's eating the cookie, and I've always maintained that. For whatever reason, if you just say something serious, it's serious. But if you say something serious with food in your mouth, it becomes slightly comedic. And he masters that.
Yeah, it's perfect.
He's good at showing anger too. He was good at showing Bean's anger when he's throwing stuff, but it wasn't as overt as it could have been, right? I mean, it was just kind of stated there.
No,
a
like,
couple chairs and stuff. But yeah, I mean,
the one scene where he flips the desk.
Yeah.
The other thing that he did that I picked up on was when he's walking out of Art Howe's office, he does this like weird shuffle. And I was like, is he doing like the Tin Man from like Wizard of Oz? Like, what's that walk?
Yeah.
I am reinvigorated by my love of the game and like does this little like Tin Man strut.
Just to drive the sarcasm home.
So good. Then shoves the laundry basket out of the way.
How about Philip Hoffman Seymour? Did I screw that up?
Yes, you did.
Yeah.
See, there you go. Even it's
He's
not
back,
even a
baby.
It's not even a sports figure I could screw up. It's awesome. There you go. It's 2020, right?
Welcome back.
So, Luke. But I mean, just doing Art Howe, like that was just awesome, right? That's just, well, he was, it's a pretty good cast, really good cast, I'll tell you.
Well, so Seymour Hoffman had worked with Bennett Miller on Capote, the movie that was filmed here in Winnipeg. And then this was their reunion. The Art Howe thing though, Howe was very upset with how he was portrayed in this movie.
Yeah. But
I've heard that it's mostly not because of how Philip Seymour Hoffman portrays him physically, like how he portrays him, like, you know, both tonally and intellectually. From what I've read and heard, it's just that he's mad that Philip Seymour Hoffman's fat. That he just doesn't like being portrayed as an overweight person, because Art Howe's kind of a health nut.
Yeah.
So that's what I've heard his big issue with it is. Isn't necessarily like how he portrayed him as like a person. It's just because of how his weight, which is insane to me.
And I guess some of the liberties were taken, like how reluctant or recalcitrant he was to like cooperate with Bean. That apparently he wasn't as big of a stick of the mud.
Well, I don't know. It depends on who you ask. Paul De Podesta has come out and said that Art Howe was one of the biggest obstacles that they've had. So I don't know. Maybe.
It could probably be also.
Yeah, I mean, because there was a couple of scenes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and remember, this is sort of the Billy Bean story, a lot of this, right?
Yeah.
In the movie version, right? So, you know, him walking in the clubhouse and talking to the guys, you know, I mean, some of that could have happened, but, I mean, to the extent that they show, you know, that's probably a little bit of liberties for movie, just to tell the narrative.
Yeah, like the Giambi scene in the locker room after the loss, like that. Is he marching? Like,
yeah, I can't see that happening.
Yeah, in the books, they do document Billy Bean's anger pretty well, but that scene with him smacking the stereo with the baseball bat wasn't part of the book. So, you know, who knows? That's probably dramatized, but it's
and then tossing funny. The bat and then flipping over the table.
That's what losing sounds like. It's just like the perfect like finger drop. Just that's what losing sounds like. So good. Yep.
One other liberty that they seem to take that I caught my eye is, so right after he meets with Shapiro and crew in Cleveland, he's flying home and they've got him reading the Bill James abstract on the flight.
Yeah.
And it's like, so he just like discovered, you know, sabermetrics, and it's like, oh, I'm just going to run out to a bookstore in Cleveland and grab this. Or like, you know, I doubt the Sky Mall had this. So how does he end up reading that on the way home?
And I mean, he in the books, he was a huge fan of sabermetrics well before that, because Sandy Alderson had gotten him into it before taking off to do Sandy Alderson things all over.
I would say this is sort of where what Brian was saying about this could be a 5-10-part series. You know, when you're doing a movie for 2 hours, you just got to jump to, you know, that Bill James guy. He's important, but not too important to this movie, right?
Yeah.
Enough that we can just put him in, and then, you know, we'll keep on going.
One point I want to make is how incredible was Reed Diamond as Mark Shapiro? Looked like him, sounded like him, act like him, on point. Can we please get him off the Jays now?
20 years later, he's still screwing you up, Brian.
Yeah.
So one thing with his meeting with Shapiro that I haven't been able to find on the internet is was that what the Cleveland offices looked like at that time with the giant Wahoo in the front entrance?
I assume very likely, but I don't know. That hasn't aged well.
No, because, I mean, if it's not, that's a choice, and that's a wild choice, but holy crow.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there's no way of really knowing for sure, but I have, because that was the logo that they were using, right? Like, Wahoo was on the hats. They hadn't even broken out just, like, the C logo. So I have to imagine that they would have had Wahoo everywhere.
Yeah. Other than Wahoo, I did appreciate how fancy their like waiting room was compared to the Oakland office waiting room, and just like contrasting the chairs and just how like low rent the chairs were in Oakland.
Yeah.
Like, as soon as you go to Oakland, you just feel like you're watching Office Space.
Yes.
Like as soon as you're there.
Yeah. It's just grimy and rusty and smelly.
Hey, Brian, you know the book more than I can't remember the book, I'll be honest, but the movie was about the when he made the trade that the Boston had to throw in, Detroit had to throw in 3 years of pop for the vending machine.
They do He, I don't necessarily know. It didn't happen in that particular way at trade deadline, but he did get someone to finance their soda machine for a number of years because... But it wasn't,
crazy.
Like Jonah Hill's line on the plane where he's like, we like to keep the money on the field or whatever. And he's like, where is my dollar showing anywhere on this field?
Yeah, Yeah, no, exactly. It's hard to see. Yeah, it is. I'm done.
I'm done.
That's incredible.
The injustice, and the other one with Hatterberg at the lunchroom is like awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Where he's like, what's your biggest general fear? And he's like, oh, the ball being hit in my general direction. And he laughs. He's like, no, really. And he's like, no, that's it.
Good luck with that.
And Hattenberg, that's Chris Pratt.
Yeah.
Yeah, Parks and Rec.
That's the young Guardians of the Galaxy guy there. Right?
Yeah. Pre-ripped.
Pre.
It was while he was doing Parks and Rec.
There you go.
But Scott Hatterberg, actually really good for a number of years after this. So the A's acquired him in 2002. He put up 3.5 wins above replacement and proceeded to continue to produce for them, putting up another 4 wins above replacement before he left for the Reds, where he put up another 4 wins above replacement for them over 3 years. It's just the rest of his career was so bad other than that he only ended up with about 12 wins above replacement on his career.
So that trade for Pena was a good trade, obviously.
No, that was a really stupid trade, because even though Hatterberg ended up being better that year,
right.
Carlos Pena ended up being really, really good for a number of years other than that. And it completely went against the sort of thing that, the A's were about, right? So Hatterberg put up 3.5 wins above replacement in 2002, and Pena only put up a half a win above replacement. Over the next 3 years, Pena still about a half win above replacement, but then for the 07 Devil Rays, he put up 6. That's like MVP territory. Then 4 in 2008 and 3 again in 2009. So, you know, Pena ended up being better over the course of his career and for a huge 3-year peak. But at the moment that they really needed it, it was better, you know?
Did any of you do kind of an internet dive on either the movie or the team after watching this at all?
Every single time.
I do. I have in the past, but then I just found myself not enjoying the movie as much the next time I watch it. I tend to stray away from it now when I watch it, but
I will say the one thing is impressive is still that streak, right? It kind of is the cap or kind of the movie there, and it's just amazing when the way it was set up, it's, you know, and it actually happened in real life. Hattenberg hits the home run to win that game, which they almost blow, and I guess being with his superstitious mannerisms and stuff. But I thought they did that well. It was kind of interesting, and I did do a little bit of a dive of just how insane that streak was. Ryan, I'm sure you know that the streak started against the Blue Jays.
Yeah, of course. Everything good always happens against the Blue Jays.
Hey, don't worry. If you watch sports, they win every year in 91 and 92. Don't worry about it. That's going to be running until we're out of quarantine or isolation. So.
Yeah, they've been winning a lot right now in the last month on Sportsnet.
I tell you, I think they're on a winning streak of 20 right now.
Yeah. Well, and in the players' video game league right now, Bo Bichette is killing it. He's super good.
Boy, let's hope he can actually translate into that the real world.
Here to talk about the Jays. Let's talk about the Oakland Athletics.
Ryan, I got to just throw it in a little bit, you know.
Of course. So, being an A's fan over these years has just kind of been crazy, right? Like, not only you mentioned before that it's every 4 or 5 years, but they've had some really good runs and brought in some incredible players. Like, they traded for John Lester, for goodness sake.
Yeah. And that's the thing is, like, when the app started going up, and it was kind of hard to follow the team for a while because it was just that lucky chance you got them on TV that night. But now, like, with the radio and the ability to subscribe to it, we're – like, I might catch anywhere from 80 to 90 games a year in full, even more so when I was working, like, on Green Team, where I could just sit in a tractor and listen to games all day. But I think the toughest thing with being a fan of the team is the aspect of the town wants them to do so well, but they are a very hot, cold town, very similar to how Winnipeg is, where the team even falls off a little bit. Right away, they think they're done for the season, and they just stop showing up. So, like, there's a fact, I was doing a little search before this, that I could go for, like, a 4-game set in Oakland for cheaper than I could get into a playoff game in Winnipeg for Jets.
Holy cow. So, like,
you can stroll into this stadium regardless, but.
Have you ever been to the Coliseum?
No, and I might not get a chance now they have the newest stadium approved. So it looks
Don't worry, that'll take forever before they build it. So
yeah, I was really like lots of time. For me, it was always Barry Zito. I was just an absolute, I was crazy about him. Like the everything about the guy, and he was very kind of reserved, and there wasn't a lot in the media about him, but it was just a very quirk. Like him and was it Dontrelle Willis were like my two favorite pitchers.
Like, oh man,
the D train.
Talk about complete opposite of the spectrum. Yeah. One insanely reserved guy, and then Dontrelle Willis was about as loud gets. Fun to watch, though. Great.
I literally coined, like, that's what I wanted my windup to be, was Dontrelle Willis, but then have, like, a Barry Zito pitch come at you was, like, apparently, like, they tell me I was just, like, the weirdest guy to watch throw. Because it looks like this heater is going to come at you, and just this gross whatever would come off of my hand. That's how I operated.
Fastball windup, meatball delivery.
Must have killed you when Zito left to go across the bay.
It did, yeah. I mean, but that's the Oakland A's fan, right? Like you just, it's the countdown as soon as they throw the first pitch or take the first hit for you, and when they're moving on.
Did Zito win a World Series with him?
With the Giants?
Yeah,
I think so. I think he was there
first one.
I think he was there for the first one.
Yeah. I don't know if he was doing much though.
But he still has a ring.
I think still collects the.
He won't discard it.
No. He pitched with the Giants until 2013. So he was there for two of them.
You know, maybe he was involved in the first one and the second one. He was on the.
He wasn't really involved in either of them. He didn't really do a lot for either of them. In the 2010 one, he pitched. Well, I guess he threw 200 innings for the 2010 one.
I think he was more involved in that one.
But he came back to the A's for one season, and he pitched seven innings for the A's in 2015.
To retire an A, is that how he
retire as an A?
I guess so. Had a 10.29 ERA over seven innings pitched.
He was one of those pitchers that were like when he was on, no one's touching him, but like if he was a centimeter off, it was a disastrous night.
Yeah, well, I mean, because it was all movement and location for him, right?
Yeah. So like if there was any point where you saw him throwing like more than three fastballs in an inning, you know it was game over. Like it's a pitching machine at that point for a lot of the guys.
Yeah.
Well, looking at the
such
time.
Such a fun movie. What a great, fun movie, though.
Great movie. Beautifully shot, too. Shout out to Wally Pfister, the cinematographer, who's done all of Christopher Nolan's movies.
It's great that they did it in the stadium. That was an extra.
Where do you guys think it ranks on all-time baseball movies?
Well, when we did our draft, I'm trying to remember where it went. I know that my number one is Bull Durham.
Right. Well, you took Sandlot number one to screw with me, and yeah. I took Moneyball number two.
Oh, those are too high. Those are too well.
I took Sandlot because I knew
Sandlot,
he wanted
a lot
it.
Of people swear by the Sandlot. I'm late Field to the game. Up there.
We didn't actually end up taking Field of Dreams. Neither Mike or Field I like Dreams. It.
You know which one I like? It's For the Love of the Game.
I took that one.
Well, we're hoping to get that as a rewatch. I've got a pal who's a huge Tigers fan, so I'm hoping to get him on. But next week, we're going to have station manager Jared Mikidiak on to talk about his favorite team with the movie Major League. So folks can watch that
Wild Thing,
and we'll talk about that. Connor, thanks very much for joining us to talk about Moneyball and appearing here on the Bench Shockies.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on. Hopefully everyone's staying safe.
Thanks again, folks. Stick around for Front Burner. Here on 101.5 UMFM.
Strike three, you're out.